Well, brethren, it goes without saying that we're living in very troubling times. The election, of course, almost 2 weeks ago now, if it taught us nothing else, it's taught us that there is a great division in our country, but it's not just in our country, it's in the world. The world seems to be more divided now than it ever has been. There seem to be more things going on around the world, diverse things, you might say, things that are causing political unrest and violence, and that's in all parts of the world. I've also learned, and I think all of us have learned, I hope we have, that as a Christian, our Christian perspective, and I believe the Bible is abundantly clear that we are citizens of another kingdom. We pray for God's will when it comes to the selection of leaders, and we pray for those leaders once selected. That's a part of who we are and what we do. But if we lose our focus during that period of time, if we allow ourselves to be caught up in some of the disputes of the world, it leads to more difficulty. Because you see, if our mission isn't the same today as it was before the election, if our goal and direction isn't the same today as it was before the election, then there must have been something wrong with our goal and direction. And I don't believe that's true. From a physical perspective, obviously things change when there's an election. From a spiritual perspective, if they change, then that probably means we were pursuing the wrong mission and the wrong goal beforehand. Because we must be clear, the true spiritual goal and direction and mission doesn't change. And we should be very clear about that. But all of this creates problems and difficulties in the world and certainly in our own country. I was reminded of the introduction to Thomas Paine's I guess it's an essay called The Crisis or The American Crisis, and it's the famous line that we're all familiar with. He says, you know, these are the days that try men's souls, or actually these are the times that try men's souls. But he goes on in that message to say this. He says, 'Tis surprising to see how rapidly a panic, this was written December 23rd, 1776, 'Tis surprising to see how rapidly a panic will sometimes run through a country. All nations and ages have been subject to them. Their duration is always short. The mind soon grows through them and acquires a firmer habit than before. But their peculiar advantage is that they are the touchstones of sincerity and hypocrisy and bring things and men to light which might otherwise have lain forever undiscovered.' I believe there's some truth to that, that in the difficult times you begin to see character and other issues that make up a person, and sometimes it's very discouraging. Let's go to Matthew chapter 24 to begin with this afternoon. Matthew chapter 24, in the Olivet Prophecy, Jesus Christ uttered these words. Rather powerful and profound, and words that have resonated with all of us as a part of the church of God for many, many years. Verse 34, Christ said, assuredly, absolutely, he says, I promise, he says, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Now, what did Christ mean by this generation would not pass away? I think we've always understood that to mean, and it's certainly confirmed in the book of Revelation, that once things begin to happen, they will happen very quickly. Once that floodgate is opened, it isn't going to be closed, and it's going to happen very quickly. The speed of what's happened with just this pandemic this past year has been absolutely incredible. 188 nations. Nations now considering lockdown, some nations locking down because the virus is still around. 8 months ago, none of us would have conceived that, at least I don't think so. 8 months in the bigger scheme of things is really a very short period of time as to how quickly things can be turned on their ear. You know, the term generation has actually two very clear meanings. A generation is defined, one definition, is the number of years it takes for children to be born and grow up to adulthood and have children of their own. This is normally considered about 20 years to 40 years. The second definition, a generation can also be defined as everyone alive at one time. Normally there are four defined age groups given different names today that are alive at one time. Four distinct groups. Sociologists tell us today that in their, again, I don't know how what we would mean by history, but in their research or the years that people have been doing this, I guess, we see today the largest gap between the oldest living generation and the youngest generation when it comes to values, when it comes to life experience. And I want to talk a little about life experience and how that affects all of us. Those in the older generation lived back in the previous century. They lived at a time that was very different than today. Their values and principles were forged by their life experiences. We must understand, we cannot expect the younger generation to have the same life experience as we did. And therefore, their values, their principles, and again, I'm speaking in general of the world, not necessarily of the church, although we're affected as well. Those values and principles were or are affected by their life experiences. And sometimes we forget that. You know, they have various names to the generations, as they call them today, based on principles from the, you know, the boomer generation and on it goes, and there are different names to identify them. But the oldest generation and the youngest generation have the largest gap in values, morals, and principles of any ever alive at one time. That shouldn't surprise us, as I said. Think about this. Think about a person born in the year 2000. We're two decades into this period of time, 20 years ago. Consider that a generation. What is the current generation, a current 20-year-old today, a sophomore in college, what is his or her life experience? Consider this. If you read it, I believe you'll see that obviously there is a difference in what previous generations experience. In the year 2000, there was a threat that called Y2K that was going to bring an end to all record keeping. Now, I'm not anywhere near an expert when it comes to computers, but as I understand it, they're based on a binary system of zeros and ones. So we were told leading up to the year 2000 that come 2000, January 1 and midnight, when everything flips over, that all the data would be lost. The computers would revert back to the year 1900 and everything would be lost. That was a very serious issue back in the late 1990s, leading up to the year 2000. We even had a packet of information. I remember very clearly we had a presentation at that time, the leadership of the church. We had a presentation explaining exactly how this was going to happen and what a disaster it was going to be. The church put together a whole packet of information, sent out to every church area, every pastor, to explain what a disaster this could potentially be. I believe millions of dollars were spent, things were corrected, and 2000 came along and it didn't happen. But there was a fear. There was a panic in some ways that went on even at that time, and even somewhat in the church. Again, I don't think it was as big a deal in the church, but that's the year a 20-year-old was born. In 2001, the 9/11 attack on the Twin Towers in New York occurred. In 2003, U.S. troops invade Iraq, which began a war that is today the longest war in American history. At 17 years and counting. 2004, Facebook was launched by Mark Zuckerberg at Harvard. The young entrepreneur launches the online social media and networking service along with his roommates, Eduardo Saverin, Andrew McCollum, Dustin Moskovitz, and Chris Hughes. 2005, terrorists hit London, leaving 56 dead and 700 injured from a series of suicide attacks targeting morning commuters in London. In 2007, Steve Jobs launches the first iPhone from Apple. In 2007, a global financial crisis that had not been since the Great Depression occurs. In 2011, the U.S. elects its first African-American president, Barack Obama. On December the 17th, 2010, Tariq El Tayeb Mohamed Bouazizi, a 26-year-old Tunisian street vendor, sets himself on fire as part of a government protest that is credited with beginning the Arab Spring. Before it ended, the governments in Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, and Bahrain were either overthrown or severely affected. The map of the Middle East changed overnight at that time. The country of Syria, of course, was involved in a very divisive civil war. Obviously, civil war is divisive, and it's still going on today. The death toll stands at 250,000 in Syria. Half the population of Syria has either been killed or displaced during this period of time. 2011 saw the raid in Pakistan that killed Osama bin Laden. 2013, Boston was the location of a terrorist bombing during the marathon that killed three and injured 264 others. Terrorism was alive and well in the United States. 2015, Greece becomes the first developed country to default on a loan from the International Monetary Fund. They defaulted on a $1.7 billion payment. There are 188 nations in the International Monetary Fund, and Greece became the first ever to default. 2015, same-sex marriage is legalized in all 50 states in the United States. 2015, on February the 13th, a terrorist attack on a theater in Paris took the lives of 90 people and injured 413. Combined with other attacks at the same time in the area, 130 total people died. 2016, Britain votes to leave the European Union. June of 2016, Omar Mateen went on a shooting spree in a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, killing 46 people. 2016, Donald Trump is elected the 45th president of the United States. October the 1st, 2017, Stephen Paddock, a 64-year-old man from Mesquite, Nevada, opened fire upon those attending the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival on the Las Vegas Strip. In 15 minutes, he fired 1,000 rounds of ammunition, killing 60 people and wounding 411. In 2017, Facebook hits 2 billion global users for the first time. Today, the number is 2.7 billion, one-third of the Earth's population. In 2018, Apple becomes the first public company to be worth $1 trillion. In 2020, the coronavirus becomes the worst pandemic in 100 years. If you're a 20-year-old today, that is your life experience. That's what you've lived through. It is what has shaped who you are in many ways. It's what's shaped many of your principles and morals. Again, I'm speaking in general, hopefully, certainly not in the church, but in general, what's occurred. We are two decades into this new century, and you get the feeling we're being prepared for something even more powerful and more dramatic, identified as the end of the age. It is no exaggeration to say that these past 20 years have been characterized as extremely violent, with staggering changes in values. LGBTQ were just letters in the alphabet 40 years ago. But in two decades in the 21st century, it refers to a group of people who have a lifestyle described as immoral in Scripture. And today, this group is a viable part of every political movement in this country, all in a generation. For the past 20 years, from 600,000 to 800,000 abortions have been reported to the CDC annually. The numbers have dropped to the lowest level in this century, in the last 10 years. But consider it 800,000 per year. We have 2,200 abortions every day. At 600,000 a year, we have 1,700 every day. In the last 20 years, since 2000, there have been 14 million reported abortions. To put that in perspective, the United States, we have 50 states. Only four states have more than 14 million people in the state: California, New York, Florida, and Texas. Consider any state you want in wiping out that entire state in this last generation. Those are the staggering numbers that we're dealing with in one generation. We go berserk over a pandemic that has taken the lives of 240,000 people in less than a year. And we don't bat an eye to the 600,000 abortions since the pandemic began and 14 million in this generation alone. So how does a 20-year-old navigate all of this? It is easy to judge and even condemn the current generation. But for them, their life experience has been built around social media expansion, unpopular wars, terrorist attacks, a society that has always accepted homosexuality as an alternative lifestyle, and political division. They've grown up in a society that requires them to repeat certain phrases: social justice, systemic racism, and use politically correct language, not because they may believe it, but because if they don't say it, they find themselves bullied and they find themselves outside of what is now considered mainstream. This is the life experience of a 20-year-old. No wonder those that are the oldest generation can look at this generation and wonder, well, what's happening to them? But it's not only this generation that's affected. These are also our life experiences and the things that have changed so much of the world. Remember, a 20-year-old can't change or control what he has experienced. This should help us understand how difficult it is, not only for young people, but for all ages in this generation, to deal with the world around them and to be able to see clearly where we're going and what we must do. My question this afternoon is, how does a 20-year-old navigate such a world given his life experience? And how do we, three other generations, navigate such a world since we are also a part of this generation? By the definition that everyone alive at one time is one generation, we're all a part of this generation. And we're all affected every single day. Is this the last generation? Is this the generation Christ spoke of in Matthew chapter 24? Remember, at some point in time, that will be fulfilled. It will be that generation, which will be everyone alive at that time, who will experience what Christ described in Matthew 24. How do we deal with all of that? What does this generation face? How will we survive spiritually? My answer this afternoon is actually found in the preteen and the teen virtual camps this past summer that you may not have been aware of. They choose a theme every year. They chose a theme this year that I thought was quite poignant. They chose it long before the pandemic, and of course we were unable to hold classes or actually hold camps this year. Their theme this year was firmly anchored, holding fast to what is good. Holding fast to what is good. I believe within this phrase lies the answer going forward into the future. Satan will do everything he can to destroy that relationship, and by all means, our relationship with God, and by all means, including our own life experiences in a world that consistently labels evil as good. The great challenge that we're all going to face, young and old and everything in between, is holding fast in a period of time that's going to be so disruptive, with so much upheaval, that it becomes so much easier to simply accept it and move on. That's the challenge. Consider Daniel chapter 7, verse 25. Daniel 7, verse 25. This is, to me, an unusual verse in the middle of an unusual prophecy. I'll read it to you from the King James Version, because this is the version that gives me the word I'm looking for, so I'm going to use it. Daniel chapter 7, verse 25 is breaking into a prophecy. It describes a prophecy of the ten horns, the little horn, and it talks about the little horn. We're talking about the end time. And here's what it says in verse 25. And he shall speak great words, this little horn, against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High. Wear out the saints. I believe it says persecute in the New King James. So that really doesn't tell you what this word means. This is the only place in Scripture that this word is used, the phrase wearing out. It's the only place. It's actually not Hebrew, it's Aramaic. And in the Aramaic, it actually means emotionally, mentally, and psychologically to wear you down. Daniel predicted a time when this false prophet's on the scene, when there's a powerful religious leader, a powerful political leader on the scene, and he says they're going to wear you out. And you know what it says in the verses following? That they will be successful to a degree until God stops it. It is a challenge that we must face and must acknowledge that we all get worn out by it all. I'm probably no different than you. You just get worn out with all that's going on right now, even in our own country. But consider if you lived in another country. I was reading the news this morning from the Ivory Coast, from Cote d'Ivoire. And they just had an election on October the 31st. And they've had consistent violence since then. 85 people reported this morning having been killed in the violence. But here's how the election went. You talk about our country. Here's how their election went. Leading up to October the 31st, there were 44 candidates for president. One of them was the incumbent, current president. He was seeking a third term, or was seeking a third term. Just before the election, an election commission declared 40 of the 44 candidates ineligible. Just declared them all ineligible. And so that left four candidates. Well, of the four candidates, two of them were declared ineligible because of corruption. One had actually mounted a coup in Cote d'Ivoire in 1999. So they were declared ineligible. That left only two candidates to vote for on October the 31st. The incumbent president got 94% of the vote. Hence, all of the violence that's occurred since then. That's just a typical election in many parts of the world. It wears you out. What if you're a member living in another country, and certainly even in our own country, and you see this year after year after year after year? You get worn out. It wears you down. Now, this word, there's an equivalent Hebrew word in the Old Testament to this one for wearing down. And it's actually, as I said, a Hebrew word. It's found in several places, but it has a similar meaning. Genesis 18, verse 12 is the usage of this word. Well, you don't have to turn there. But it's where Sarah is told that she's going to have a child at quite an elderly age. And it says she laughs when she heard it. She was told she would have a child at her age. And she then asked, well, when she's challenged on it, she asked, well, how is this possible? And she uses the term, I'm old and worn out. And it's the same Hebrew term as we find in the Aramaic term in Daniel chapter 7, verse 25, worn out. I'm just worn down. You get worn down by it all. So how do we address all of this? How do we work our way through it? How do we navigate it? I believe there is an answer. Now, I believe the answer is found, and this is the title of my sermon, hold fast to what is good. Hold fast to what is good. And the alternate expression is hold fast without wavering. This is a principle that we're going to talk about now today. There are at least seven scriptures in the New Testament where Christ used the term little faith in talking about his disciples. Let's go to Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22. This is where Christ referred to Peter. Luke chapter 22. Christ talks about Peter, and he says this. I mean, this has to be one of the more astounding things, if you're Peter, of your entire experience with Jesus Christ. Luke 22, verse 31. The Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you, that he may sift you as wheat. Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. Now, that's an unusual conversation. I don't know how you begin that conversation. You know, where do you start with? And, of course, we don't have everything that was said. But to turn to someone and say, well, Satan wants you. Satan really wants you. He wants to sift you like wheat. Now, growing up on the farm, we used to grind our own corn, grind it into cornmeal. And you would have various levels of a sieve that would, you would have one that had bigger holes, and you'd go through the first, and you'd go through another. And to get it down to cornmeal, you had to go through several of them to get it down to that particular level in sifting it through. So I sort of imagine what Christ was saying to Peter is, you know, he's going to come at you and come at you and come at you. Sifting like wheat is not a one-time event. This is something that he's going to do until he wears you down. And that's Satan's operation. Satan, he has whatever time he has, and he knows that. It's a matter of wearing you down. And he comes at you from every angle, every day, consistently to wear you down. But Christ goes on to say, but I have prayed for you. Now, what did Christ pray for Peter? That you have a lot of money, that you have a great job, that you never get sick, that you have all of these things, all these blessings. He didn't say that. What did he say? I've prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. The prayer for Peter in the face of being told Satan is after you, I believe we could say the same thing today. Satan is after us. He really is. And so Christ looks at us and he says, I'm praying that your faith doesn't fail. Now, we think in other ways. We think, well, you know, I hope God will let me get this job. I hope God will take care of this. I hope God will do that. I hope God keeps me from getting sick. I hope, you know, and I hope and I hope and I hope. When was the last time we simply put it into God's hands and says, you know, please increase my faith. I really need more faith. I really, really do. Christ said that to Peter. Christ did not pray that Peter would never become ill or experience any difficulties, but in the face of difficulties and trials, that his faith would not fail. The worst thing that can be said of any of us is that our faith failed. Not that we even became ill, or that we became ill and died, or that we struggled in life. We were never wealthy or great. The worst thing that can be said about us is that our faith failed. That's a problem. And that, of course, is the opposite of how we should face the challenges ahead. Look at Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18 is the famous parable about the importuning widow. But on the heels of this parable, in verse 7, Christ said this: "And shall God not avenge his own elect, who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them?" There are things in life that God will not take away. There are things in life that you and I must endure day after day after day after day. That's a part of life. God just doesn't take it all away. He says, "Though he bears long with them, I tell you that he will avenge them speedily." God will. There is a day of reckoning. It is coming. But he says, "Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth?" To my knowledge, the New King James is the only translation that uses the word "really." King James doesn't. It says, "Will he find faith?" The New King James adds, "really find faith." And I've been curious about that, want to find out, well, why? Why is this the only translation? The King James and the New King James come from the same Greek text. So why is the word "really"? Well, if you do a little more study, you'll find that the word "find" here is one of great feeling. Great feeling. It's not just the word, well, like you found something, you stumbled over it walking around, but it's something that has a depth of feeling, emotion to it. So in the King James, in order to bring that emotion out, instead of having the word "find," they added the word "really" to give emphasis to the word "find." Will he really find faith on the earth? This is a point of great consternation we see to Jesus Christ at this point. In Barnes's notes, it says this: "The truth that he had been teaching was that God would deliver his people from their calamities and save them, though he suffered them to be long tried. He asked them here whether when he comes he should find this faith or a belief of his truth among his followers. Would they be found persevering in prayer and believing that God would yet avenge them, or would they cease to pray always and faint?" Robertson's New Testament word picture says this: "It is not clear whether this sentence is also a question or a positive statement." Is it a question or a positive statement? There's no way to decide. Either will make sense, though not quite the same sense. On the whole, the interrogative is probably correct. It's probably a question, meaning to question if the Son will find a persistence of faith like that of the widow when he does return. You know, there's some startling statistics today that you can find very easily. As I said, the difference in the gap between the youngest generation, the 20-year-old, and the 60-year-old, and the older generation, or the oldest generation, is larger than it's ever been. There is very little, it seems, and again, in a world issue, there's very little association between the two in the world where we live. And you can see that churches or religion has consistently failed not just this generation, but previous generations. It's statistically true that only one out of every three teenagers that's sitting in church today will actually attend church when they're out on their own. One out of three is what it amounts to. And you can begin to see why. Religion today has become a mockery in many ways. It's become, in some places, a circus. We have individuals who just this past month, predicted the return of Jesus Christ on the last great day. We have others that are predicting that President Trump is sort of like a king in the Old Testament, and that God's going to perform a miracle and he has to be the next president. There are people making those predictions in the name of religion. Is there any reason why a young person of 20 years old would be attracted to that at all? The mockery that's being made of religion all around us is incredible. And you can see why a 20-year-old would say, well, I don't really want to be a part of that. What is the one problem that pops up over and over again? the one problem that never gets discussed, and that's really the issue of faith. When is the last time we addressed the issue, or you addressed the issue, or you heard the issue addressed of having more faith? Now, maybe you have. I'm sure, obviously, things have been said. Think about it in the terms of the holy days. The last holy day or festival this year was the last great day. It will now be 6 months before there'll be another festival, and that'll be the Passover. I'm sure you know this. You may not have thought of it in this way. All of the festivals appear in a six-month period of time. All of them occur in a six-month period of time, or at least a portion of that. According to the Hebrew calendar, there are exactly 177 days every single year. 177 days between Nisan 1 and Tishri 1, the beginning of the year and the Feast of Trumpets, 177 days. There are always 163 days between Passover and Trumpets every single year. So within a little over 177 days, all of the festivals take place. And then we come to this kind of dark period of time where we go for 6 months without a single festival. Again, you can have your own reasons, or at least you can imagine why did God do it that way? Of course, you know the agricultural principles and all of that. But there's also a picture here. It's a picture of holding on during a time of darkness, holding on during a time when you don't have the uplift and the enthusiasm and excitement of a festival, but to hold on without wavering, to not fail. You know, it used to be years ago, and some of you were probably a part of that, where you would hear every year at the feast, at least I remember hearing it as a child, that some of you will not be here next year. That it's just a foregone conclusion that some of you will not be a part of the church a year from now, from one feast to the next. And at those years, all we had were the feasts and to get together. We had no local congregations. So people, over extended periods of time of being alone without the support of others, becomes so much easier to fail in that period of darkness that we go through. You know, faith is not exclusively tied to healing, which some people try to make it. There is a misnomer sometimes among people that has thrived over the years. If you had faith, you would be healed. While faith and healing are associated, one must be careful not to jump to the conclusion that if you only had more faith, you would be healed. Christ healed many people who had no faith, and he praised people who knew little about him or what he taught as having great faith. Healing is a personal promise from God and not an institutional promise. It isn't a promise that just because you attend church, therefore you must be healed. It is a personal promise that God makes, that you and I can claim as Christians, as followers of God's way. Our responsibility, each and every one of us as Christians, when a brother or sister is sick, is to pray in faith for God's mercy and intervention. It is our place to encourage, support, and cry out to God. The rest is up to God. That is not what some people think of as faith. When the disciples asked Christ to increase their faith, another famous dialogue that took place between Christ and his disciples, he did not answer them directly. He did not say, go do 1, 2, 3, and 4, and you will increase your faith. He didn't say, keep the Sabbath better, keep the holy days better, do all of these things better, and you will have more faith. Now, he didn't say you shouldn't do any of those things either. What did he say? Luke chapter 17, a little further along in this chapter. Luke 17, and again in verse 5. Luke 17, well, going back a chapter, Luke 17, verse 5. He says, and the disciples said to the Lord, increase our faith. They became aware as they matured with Christ that faith is a big deal. Faith is a big deal. You know, if you stop and think about it, and again, I'm not trying to give a political statement, but there was a time when the political campaign said, you know, it's the economy. Stupid, it's the economy. You know, that's it. Again, I'm not calling anybody stupid, but it's faith. That's the issue. That's the point. It's faith. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. And each and every one of us must answer for the faith that we individually have. No one else can give it to you. The disciples asked Christ, well, how do we increase our faith? What did he say? How did he answer that? Well, he didn't answer directly, but he gave a story. First of all, he said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots and be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. And which of you, having a servant plowing or rending, tending sheep, will say to him when he has come in from the field, come at once and sit down and eat? But will he not rather say to him, prepare something for my supper and gird yourself and serve me till I have eaten and drunk, and afterward you will eat and drink? Does he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? I think not. So likewise, verse 10, so likewise you, when you have done all those things which you are commanded, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done what was our duty to do. The point Christ is making is that if you're a servant and you're out working in the field, when you come in, you're a servant. When you come in, your work isn't over just because you did what was immediately asked of you. So what Christ is saying to the disciples is you're a servant 24 hours a day. So you can never say, well, I did my job, therefore give me this. He says, you're always a servant, always a servant. And if you go above and beyond, your faith will increase. Above and beyond, your faith will increase. It's not just a matter of how many Sabbaths have you observed, or how many holy days you've been to, or how many feasts you've attended. It's have you gone above and beyond? Are you prepared to help others? Are you prepared to serve? Are you prepared to commit your life? That's how you increase faith. That's how you increase faith. You go beyond the 8 to 5 or 9 to 5, whatever it may be, that a person would be assigned to work. You never leave that job as a servant. Let's go to Hebrews. I think you can't talk about faith without going to Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 11. There are two verses here that become very important in this whole subject. Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And then verse 6. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. Faith is a big deal. Faith is a big deal. Without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. This is an unusual chapter, chapter 11, called the faith chapter. There are 16 times in this chapter where it says, by faith, Enoch, by faith, Noah, by faith, by faith, by faith, by faith. They're pointing out that it was all done how? By personal strength, by personal wealth, by faith, by faith, by faith. 6,000 years have gone by, and those that God has pointed out, certainly those in Scripture, he says, by faith, by faith, by faith. Faith is a big deal. Faith is a big deal. Now, if you look at the Bible as a book, which we obviously do, you'll find that often when God makes statements such as this, now faith is, we start chapter 11 with, there's often a setup for that. In other words, it doesn't just come without context. Now, my personal feeling is the Apostle Paul wrote the book of Hebrews. That's what I've felt all my life. I've seen it. I realize there are challenges to that, but that Paul wrote it. I think it sounds like Paul. But in chapter 10, there's the setup for chapter 11. Rest of the sermon, I want to go to chapter 10 because I believe this is what sets up our understanding of faith and what gives us our direct orders as to how we're going to survive the challenges ahead. Because the challenges ahead are going to be very severe. Let me just read a portion of Hebrews chapter 10, and then we're going to come back. Because in chapters 10, I believe, are embedded the lead up to chapter 11. Chapter 11 talks about something that's already happened. It's talking about something that you already have. Chapter 10 describes what you have in terms that I believe we can understand. And it becomes a part of who we are. Chapter 10, beginning in verse 19. It says, therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil that is his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God. Verse 22, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Verse 23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. Verse 24, and let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. This begins the setup. This tells us where we're going, and we're going to talk about faith as a fact in chapter 11. Then go to verse 32. But recall the former days in which after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle both by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me and my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and an enduring possession for yourselves, and it says in the New King James, in heaven. Your margin says this is not found in heaven, isn't found in all of the translations. Again, we can understand it that our, you know, a reward is in heaven. That doesn't mean you're going to heaven. But it makes a lot more sense if the words in heaven certainly don't appear there. Verse 35, therefore do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith. That's quoted from Romans, and it's also quoted from the book of Habakkuk. The just shall live by faith. But if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. In verse 39, for we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but those who believe to the saving of the soul. So let's back up a moment. There are several things in this chapter and in these verses that lay the groundwork for what faith really is, and how faith should act in all of us, or how faith should cause all of us to act. Notice verses 23 and 24. These are a couple of the key verses. It says, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. The term hold fast in verse 23 comes from a Greek term that means to hold back, to prevent from drifting, to used as a nautical term of a ship to prevent it from heading in the wrong direction. To hold fast means more than to simply hold on. It implies taking a preemptive action. As you see the boat before it begins to even drift, you take a preemptive action. The verb or the word here in the Greek has the implication of a preemptive action. You're not just standing there holding on, but you're doing something to prevent a fall from occurring. The word faith here is actually unusual. That's used here in verse 23 as well. It's actually the more common word for hope. In fact, this is the only time this Greek word is translated faith in the New Testament. Every other time it's translated hope. And it implies, of course, again, what hope really tells us. The word means anticipation, looking forward with confidence. As I said, it's the only place it's translated faith. Everywhere else, it's translated hope. And then finally, the word wavering comes from the Greek word that means not leaning, firm and upright. It is used often of ships, that they maintain balance, especially in rough waters. Whatever is going on around the person, he is upright. The test of true Christianity is how we react in the middle of the storms. In these verses, Paul provides us with five things that help us to establish our faith. Help us to establish the groundwork for what we should be and what we should continue to be. These five things are found here. Verse 22, let us draw near with a true heart. Verse 23, let us hold fast our possession of faith. Number 3, verse 24, let us consider one another. Number 4, verse 32, let us call to remembrance the former days and those who were with us. And verse 38, live by faith. This is all the prelude to what Paul describes in the faith chapter in chapter 11. Let's consider each one of these. Take a look at how they impact our lives. What does it mean to have a true heart? It means it's genuine. There's nothing false about you. You speak from the heart and you act from the heart. You know, we're told in Matthew 7, verse 21, that those who give lip service to God and his way of life are certainly not going to get a good response from God. It's called lip service. This is not lip service. This is truly from the heart, a true heart. You know, over the years, I had the opportunity as a church pastor to visit many, many people in many, many homes, certainly in the hundreds, if not even more. There were periods of time where I visited every single day of the week, you know, except for the Sabbath, probably you were visiting new people. And you always had this wondering in the back of your mind, well, will they actually, in those years, you contacted a minister and he would come visit you before you ever came to church. And so you'd go visit them and sort of in the back of your mind, will this person actually show up? Will they really come to church? Now, there are those that do and there are those that don't. I always remember this one young couple in New England when I was a pastor there. And I didn't hear from them. I didn't know them. They showed up at church one day. They rode a bicycle to church in New England in the fall of the year. And they were in downtown Boston. They were going to school. They were both students. And they rode a bicycle. Now, church met in a place called Concord, Massachusetts. It was 20 miles from Boston. They rode a bicycle to church and showed up. And they obviously didn't know very much about it. They were there. They somehow had found us, and they came, which was all fine. And I met them, talked to them, introduced myself, and asked to visit them. And I visited them in a little apartment in the center of Boston, just off Government Square in Boston. They were students at Boston University. Well, the obvious question came up, at least in my mind, were they married? No, they were not. And they had their little apartment. Again, even at that time, for them, that seemed fine. We were living together. We could share expenses. We were, you know, we'll get married one day. We're together. So I went through and explained that, thinking, well, I'll never see them again. But as I was explaining it to them, you could see on their faces that they understood right away. And they agreed completely that, well, yeah, that's right. And you began to not judge people, but you began to see the open heart, the desire, the sincerity would come out. Because sometimes you would visit people and you would spend 4 and 5 hours. I've left many homes at 3 and 4 in the morning, having talked all night. And you see the willingness of heart, the sincerity of heart. They don't have it all together, but it's that pure heart, that true heart. And sure enough, they came to church 2 weeks later again, and they were now married. And they were happy to come see me. And they became true pillars in a congregation in New England over the years. But I always thought of that true heart and what that means. There was no deception there. There was no trying to hide anything there. It was a true heart. That's what God wants. That's what leads to faith. When you're not what you pretend to be or what you're trying to pretend to be, you're not going to be building faith. It's a sham. But that true heart is so important. The second piece of advice that Paul gives is found also in verse 23. He talks about hold fast, hold fast. You know, hold fast doesn't mean just stand still. It doesn't just mean to stand still. If you think of flying an airplane, if an airplane goes into a stall, there's only one thing that's going to happen. It's going to fall. I'll guarantee you it'll fall if you don't come out of the stall. If you do nothing, if you try to sit there in the air, you're going to fall. The same principle works in life. You can't just stand still. That's not the way you increase faith. The third piece of advice that Paul gives is found in verse 24. He says, consider one another and provoke to love and good works. We provoke individuals in several ways, but the most important way is by our conduct. I wish, if I could solve all the problems for all of us by giving one sermon, that would be great. The best piece of advice I ever got when I started out many, many years ago was that don't think you're going to save the church with one sermon, one message, or one article. It just isn't going to happen. People are more moved by who you are and your conduct as opposed to your words. Even the most powerful and moving sermon you could ever give, it has a limited impact. Now, again, I'm not saying people's lives haven't been changed because they heard something one time. That's certainly been true. But the principle is true changes occur because you provoke someone to good works, not by your words, by your deeds. You provoke them to good works. Now, the word provoke here is often used negatively, at least in the English language. But at that particular time, the word provoke didn't have a negative meaning. It meant to arouse, to excite, to call to action. So to encourage people, it wasn't a negative thing. You're not provoking them in the sense that we think of it today. You know, I think about church and what church really means, and certainly I think about what it means to me, and I believe means to many of you as well. It's not just coming to hear a message, it's coming to be with people. There's a camaraderie and a unity about that that cannot be replaced in any other way. As a young pastor, go back a number of years ago, and a pastor for many years, every congregation I served in, every Sabbath that I went to church, I had a goal in mind. My goal was to speak to every single member in the congregation every single Sabbath. And I pastored congregations in New England of 800 people, a congregation in Houston of 670 people. And I can tell you, I left services many times frustrated because I knew I didn't talk to everyone. But I would often joke to the members that I didn't need someone to tell me who was at church and who wasn't. I knew from standing as a sermon, I knew who was there and who wasn't there. Partly because they all sat in the same seats every week. And I made that comment one time in services. And then a couple of weeks later, I got up to give the sermon and I got dizzy because they weren't in the same seats. So they had decided how they did it. This was before, email and all of that. They decided before church they would all swap seats and see if I really was true to what I said. And so everybody on the right side moved to the left side. Everybody on the left moved to the right. And it actually made me nauseous and dizzy to look up, and I didn't see people in their right place. But I knew where they were. And my goal every Sabbath was to talk to them because I knew my interaction through a sermon was good. I hope it was good. But my interaction personally was going to be more important for me and for them. To provoke, you provoke people by being with them. You provoke them by being with them. That's a big part of what the church is. Number four, Paul said, remember the past. He says, remember what it was like when you were called. Remember what it was like when you were illuminated. And remember those who were there with you going through the same experience. Now, I dare say that all of us remember the people that were either baptized with us or that were in the church at the time we came into the church. And we formed a bond with those people that, again, there are some that aren't around, there are some that are deceased, but we still have that bond because we were going through the same things together, and we learned the truth together. I got a really good piece of advice when I was baptized a number of years ago. The individual that baptized me, he said, go tonight, you're going to be baptized tomorrow, which was the evening before Passover that year. And he said, write yourself a letter and detail exactly how you feel. Be as expressive as you can because it's only for you. Describe how you feel at this moment in time. And I did. And he said, every year before Passover, pull that letter out and read it and see where you are in light of that. And there's something of value. I think that's what Paul is saying here. Think about how you felt when you came into this. The enthusiasm, the excitement, and those who were there with you. I remember as clearly today as, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the people who were in the church when we first came into the church. Again, many of them are either deceased or are not around anymore, but I remember them because we were going through the same things together. Loss of jobs because of the feast. We went through the same trials and difficulties together and formed a bond. Number five. Paul says it very simply, sort of a summary statement, that we walk by faith, verse 38. This tells us that faith is an everyday activity and not a weekly exercise. How much faith do you have today, and what will you do today? How can you show your faith today? James said it very clearly, faith without works is dead, that we need that as well. Faith is worth fighting for. Faith is worth fighting for. I read a book, a number of years ago called The Death of a Salesman. It was actually a play written by Arthur Miller in 1949. It's a story of Willie Loman, a traveling salesman who hits a midlife crisis. He begins to feel the wear and tear of the years. He was a salesman for 40 years, and he always felt that he was fake. He always had to stretch things. He always had to be something different than who he was. And over time, he became worn out. And his family rejected him because they saw this fake person and they never saw the real person. And he was just worn out. And of course, it's a very sad story because he commits suicide, drives a speeding car into a brick wall or whatever and kills himself because he felt so fake and he was worn out being something he wasn't. He could never feel comfortable being himself. Daniel called it wearing out the saints. Wearing out the saints. You know, sadly, over the years, I've seen people, even in the church, who just get worn out. And sometimes, again, people take their own lives. That's happened as well. One of the very first funerals that I ever did at the age of 24 was for a suicide. And the family was deeply grieving because of that. But again, people get worn out. I'm not suggesting, obviously, that's not a good way to approach it. But people get worn out. It is possible to do that. It's really possible. There was a story that was given a number of years ago. I don't think it's a true story, but I think it makes a point about faith. It's a story of an old man crossing the Mojave Desert in the days of the pioneers. There's an old timer by the name of Desert Pete in this story. He blazed the trail through the desert and actually lived in the desert for much of his life. When he died, he dug a well in the middle of the desert, deep enough to reach the water table, and he put an old hand pump on the well. He left a message for anyone who would stumble on the well. This man stumbled upon the well, and he was dying of thirst, as the story goes. And he found Desert Pete's message, saying that a jug of water was buried in the ground about 10 feet away. And he should dig that water up, and he shouldn't drink it. He should prime the pump with it, and he'll have all the water he would ever want to drink, and then he can provide it for someone else. Of course, that was the challenge. You're dying of thirst, and you have a jug of water. What do you do? Now, for those who've been around, pumping water, growing up, that was one of my jobs on the farm, is we had a well, but it wasn't deep enough to provide drinking water, but it provided water for other things, and we would fill barrels, and you have to go out and pump it. And you had to take water, and you had to prime that pump. You had to swell those gaskets in order to get a suction in order to pump it. If you didn't have water to prime it with, you weren't going to get anything out of that well. That's the point here. Are you willing to take that water that you have now and use it so others can benefit? How does your faith benefit others? How does your faith benefit you? You know, faith isn't just, it is personal, it is private in one sense, but your faith affects others. You inspire and encourage others. You provoke others by your faith. That's very, very important. We're living in a generation that the world has never seen the like before. Could it actually be that faithless generation in the end time? Could it actually be the generation that faces all of the things that Christ talked about in the Olivet Prophecy? Our ultimate struggle is to increase our faith in the middle of a faithless generation. Maybe we are that last generation. It sure feels like it, especially today. Prophecy is being fulfilled at a rapid clip. Tragedies will continue. Death is a part of life. You know, the scripture tells us that the death of a saint is precious in God's sight. We need to take God at his word and realize that's really true. Not that we want anyone to lose his life. Not that we want to see anyone taken away from this precious opportunity. But it happens. I think in the last 3 weeks, at least, two of my classmates from college have died. But if someone dies in the faith, that's the term we use, in the faith, their death is precious in the eyes of God and therefore should be precious to us as well. And we should thank God for their lives and thank God for the faith that provoked others. You know, we are to hold fast to the profession of our faith. Hold fast the profession of your faith. Don't let go and do not waver, Paul said. Have a true heart. Hold fast. Provoke one another. Remember the past and those who were there with you and walk by faith. God is real, you are one of his children, and the kingdom is coming. What happens with an election, as we just witnessed, who God allows to lead this nation is in his hands. What you are and what you become is in your hands. And that's important. Faith is a big deal.